Well, what kind of person do you see coming into your shop looking for information and equipment for recreational gold panning?
It's a broad statement, broad question, broad answer. You see people that come up from the lower states thinking the mindset that they can come up here and make a living panning gold. These people I have to dissuade. The others of the spectrum are the people that are seasoned, who have had 2 or 3 years of experience, and they know where they're going, why they're going there, and what they can expect to find. But these are the people that have done their homework, both the literature searches and the field work. So, the answer to the question is that the people who come up from the lower states have no background, no literature research, no field experience. Some of them don't even wear the proper clothing to be in the field, in dress shoes and slacks. This doesn't send the message that they are really outdoor kind of people. Many of the people that I run into are destitute. Street people, barely got up here, financed their way up here, looking for the riches that they might find in Alaska, either through gold mining, which they have watched so many of these new television shows out, they seem to think that it's so easy to find the gold. And then the other side is some of the people that either have always lived here or come up from the outer states and have had experience, know how to approach gold mining here in the state of Alaska. So it's kind of a broad spectrum in that respect. Now, that's just the gold mining equipment, from gold pans to suction dredges. In my store, of course, I also have the rock and mineral enthusiasts. Some of them just like the pretty little shiny things. Others like specific minerals. They want to know the composition and where they came from and all about them, their history. And so that's the kind of thing that we provide them. So there's really almost two sets of people in each group, both in the mineral interest group and in the placer mining group. I think that'll answer your question.
What about the novices that come in and, you know, they just want to be able to go to a creek nearby and find a flake maybe? What kind of equipment do you tell those people to get?
Well, those people, I tell them to pick up what I call the kit. The kit consists of the equipment necessary to have an enjoyable time out on a remote stream and not become frustrated. And that kit includes a gold pan, a screen for screening out the larger rocks before panning, a suction bottle, which is used to suck the gold particles out of the pan once they find them, and a vial to put them in. And if they don't have a shovel, we have a little backpacker shovel that is available. So this is the basic tools that I suggest. No more, no less, no sluice boxes, nothing like that. We just want to get them into the field, have a good time as inexpensively as possible.
What about the people that are into suction dredging? What's allowed in Alaska?
Well, there are certain limitations depending on which land you are on, whether you're on BLM land or on state land. I'll go so far as to say that a 6-inch dredge is the largest dredge that is, in generally speaking, a 6-inch dredge is the largest dredge you can use. In most places. Now, with a permit, I think you can get permission to use larger dredges. But there's another thing that comes into play here, and that's the permit from Fish and Game. Now, there's no charge for that permit, but what they want to do is make certain you understand that when it's fish spawning time, you don't get to dredge. You have to bring that to a close. So you go to the Fish and Game, you get your permit, acknowledging that you understand that when it's fish spawning time, that you shut your operation down. And this is on anadromous fish streams. They don't even have to be anadromous fish. When it's spawning time, shut down. If there was one permit that I would say had meaning, that is the permit. After all, most of these guys fish, and they like to suction dredge. So, you know, you don't want to mess up your fishing by suction dredging in a time when it isn't conducive to the propagation of fish, which you enjoy doing as well. So think about that, and there's a positive side to that one.
Yeah,
it's visible.
Why don't you have a little? Yeah, in fact, when the price of gold was, you know, like $35 an ounce, and then things changed. What did you see happening in Alaska?
What did I see throughout the years since 1974?
Yes.
Well, I saw the price of gold start spiraling upward until 1983. There was a big gold rush into the state, and this is where we had a real problem. And I'm going out on a limb here, but people from outside, as well as people from inside, began mining, but they weren't mining in an environmentally sensitive fashion. They were ripping everything up. They were tipping oil barrels over. They were leaving junk equipment on site, and they were making a mess. And I told a couple of miners this, and they told me I was an environmentalist. Well, maybe I am to a small extent, but I am pro-mining. I am an environmentalist, in fact, but I'm not foolish enough to believe that our nation could sustain itself without mining. It cannot. So what I am going to say is we had a lot of freedoms here. Well, they abused it to the point where EPA took a big look at them, the state of Alaska, DEC, took a big look at them, and regulations started coming into play, as well as some laws, if I'm not mistaken. And these regulations started to put a little pressure on the mining industry, so they had to rethink their position and begin mining in a more environmentally sensitive fashion. And today, I believe they're doing a splendid job. There's a few out there. You've heard of them. Briex was one of them. The scams that go on. But they're not always, you know, just by experience by a corporation doesn't mean all of them are that way. Actually, the number of honest mining companies in operation far exceed the unscrupulous people that are out there. In fact, you can, I don't think it's 1 out of 100, probably 1 out of 1,000 is unethical about their approach. Certainly, and I have to laugh, somebody was complaining about so-and-so, this mine and that mine and the oil company. And I asked them, do you own any mutual funds? And, we've invested heavily in various kinds of mutual funds. I said, did you ever stop and look who is part and parcel of that particular fund that you're in, those that you were in? And they said, no. And I said, you can bet that many of them are oil companies, mining companies, successful mining companies, and the fund manager's job is to make certain that mutual fund makes money for you. So in fact, indirectly, you're a stockholder in that company. And you're sitting here telling us that you don't like that company because it's making too much money. In fact, what you're saying is you're making too much money because you're making money off that company. So, you know, that's an emotional statement based on no examination of your own stock portfolio. It's just, it doesn't hold water to a knowledgeable person. So this bothers me a little bit, that people don't even know that they are making a portion of their livelihood off of the mining industry, and probably very good mining industry, mining companies at that, or corporations, because the stockholder is not going to invest money, or excuse me, the portfolio manager is not going to invest in companies that are failures. I mean, he wouldn't have a job very long. Well, that being said, I want these companies to be successful. And yet, they're being, in many cases, they have been pressured by legislation through harder and harder requirements to open their mine. Now, I'm going to touch on a sensitive subject right here, and that's the Pebble Mine. I don't know what the Pebble Mine is all about, but I do know this, that as early as 12 years ago, actually it was 15 years ago, there was problems with the Pebble Mine. And at that time, there were 23 different state and federal agencies who had given them a stamp of approval to go ahead with the mine. And what bothers me most is people say, oh, this is bad, that's bad, the other thing is bad. This is wrong with them, that's wrong with them. What about this? What about that? I don't know what about those things, but I'm certain those people that gave them the permit knew something about those things. Not some layperson off the street who has some emotional feeling that has nothing substantial behind it. What my question is to some of these people is, do you realize that we have one of the best educational systems in the world here in the United States? And they say, oh, what about Japan? What about China? What about this place? What about it? Have you been there? Well, all their students are just, they come over here are really, you know, they're really top. No, of course they are. You think they're going to send their incompetence over here? They send a spattering of students over here of the very highest quality. They don't send mediocrity over here. So, and why are they sending them over here? Because the educational system in the United States is very high. We have an excellent tertiary educational system here. Excellent. By far superior to anything else in any other country. Now, my question is, if you believe in your education system, and you believe your education system is graduating qualified people in all phases of education, would you rather have those qualified people who have studied these kinds of things in depth make a decision on whether a mine opens, or would you rather just grab somebody off the street who has an emotional stake in it, nothing more? I vote for the educated person to make that decision. If they can find fault, they have a reason for it, and it's not something that is just quick drawn and from the hip. It's based on, in my view, would be based on solid scientific evidence. And it's not just one person. It's a group of people, a group of scientists. And a group of scientists are not going to sacrifice their reputation when they know that something is inaccurate. They will not do that. Not a quality scientist. And that's what we have in the United States. So we've got quality scientists in all these organizations, 23 organizations. They made a decision that the Pebble Mine can open, and yet it hasn't opened. What stopped them? Well, emotion, perhaps. So we have an emotional thing battling science. This brings us to a situation where we have the altruist versus the producer. The altruist being the person who believes that everybody should have everything equal. And the producer says, well, that can't happen because we do all the work. They're getting all the benefit, a lot of the benefits. And we have to keep the doors open here. And so they're making the money that is the backbone supporting the United States. And you can't, I mean, in my view, you can't have everybody sucking off the producers. Pretty soon the balance is going to tilt. And there are going to be so few producers that they can't support. And then you have a state, like one of our states in the lower coterminous United States, that goes bankrupt. Because they're trying to support all the altruists who think everybody should be equal financially. And it doesn't happen. They probably have more homeless people on the street corner than any other state in the union. I'll not mention that, go any deeper than that. I'm getting off on a tangent.
Yeah, let's go back to
mining.
Yeah, right. Let's go back to amateur mining, basically.
Okay.
What about, say, people come in with metal detectors? That's another group of people, isn't it, that are using metal detectors to find things?
Sometimes. Now, sometimes it's the same. A person doing gold dredging. Example, there is a metal detector manufacturer that has a detector that will go underwater with headphones to a depth of 10 feet. And a person diving would use that detector down at 10 feet to sweep the gravels on the floor of the stream. And that detector would detect hot spots, nuggets, things of that nature. And then he would dredge that spot. So you see, a very competent miner, suction dredger, would use the two in combination.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a secret of mine. I wasn't supposed to tell you.
Okay, well, again, back to the amateur. Screening is really important, isn't it, for the amateur to screen their bigger rocks out of the pan?
Well, certainly. Screening plays a significant role in the extraction of gold. All the gold extraction devices work more efficiently if the gold or the rocks are screened to a very small window of size. I think I can use something as an example. If you screen everything through a screen door screen, you're getting about a minus, 20 mesh, let's say. And so we can extract that minus 20 mesh gold much easier from the remaining what we call gang material or low specific gravity material and concentrate than we can if you have a whole stack full of aggregate that is variable in size. And you say, well, what about the stuff that is larger than 20 mesh? Well, then there's another screen above that, perhaps 12 mesh that you might want to use. And that's 12, when I say mesh, that's how many wires to the inch. So you got 12 mesh and 20 mesh. And below 12, which is much larger in orifice size, is the 8 mesh. And what's bigger than the 8? The 4 mesh. And then the 2 mesh, you see. And so you can keep that window narrow and extract the different sizes of gold that occur in each level. 2 to 4, 4 to 8, 8 to 12, 12 to 20, 20 to 30, 30 to 50, and 50 to 100. Those are examples. Those windows are very narrow, and because they're so narrow, it's much easier to extract the gold from that particular cut of the aggregate than it is the entire span of aggregate.
Good point. Another question is about some of the more popular areas in Alaska that are easier for, say, an amateur to get into a creek and find something. Do you know that, are there some general areas that have better possibilities?
In a general statement, there are areas that are more favorable. Hope, down on the Kenai Peninsula is a favorite place. 40-mile area is certainly one of the most high-producing gold places in the state. Up towards Central and Circle, towards the Yukon River, that's high potential. Up past Coldfoot, in the Coldfoot area, and farther up in the Brooks Range is a very high potential area. And then over towards McGrath, northwest of McGrath is a very popular area. So there's certain cores that have it. Fairbanks, again, is a very popular area because it has some domes in the area, and the domes were fed by solution producing granites that were the core to those domes, and those fluids that migrated out from those granites carried the gold and other minerals into veins that were ultimately eroded away, and then the gold became distributed in the streams as placer deposits. And yet, we have the gold in the streams that are placer deposits, but simultaneously we have enough gold remaining in the hard rocks to make hard rock mines, both of the family size proportion to the large scale mining company corporation. Side like Fort Knox, and so there's those, the Fort Knox deposit, somewhat different. It is a mixture of fine gold in which is required cyanidation to extract, and the larger gold which can be collected through mechanical methods, tables and jigs and things of that nature.
How would you advise a newcomer to approach, how to approach a creek to test it?
Well, there's just certain characteristics of a stream. And these are presented in a lot of books around the boulders on the stream bars, inside of curves of streams, things of that nature. And there's a whole series of collection points that a prospector should learn. And I can't sit here and say, at the bottom of a waterfall and go through systematically every one of these things. But there are books out on the market that maybe they don't treat them all thoroughly, but there are some fairly good books that will give you the basics of where to collect sediment for panning. Once you have established that a creek has gold in it, then you have to determine whether or not, what kind of gold it is. Now, all the gold's the same, perhaps, in the stream, but what kind of depositional pattern it has. Flood gold, it has one characteristic in mining, and if it's pastry gold, it has another characteristic. Now, the difference between pastry gold and flood gold is that let's do flood gold first. Flood gold is that gold that's small enough and fine enough to be brought down by the stream during a flood stage. And then when the flood is over, it will drop its load on the riverbank. And it will occur on the inside of the stream, because the inside of the stream is a low mechanical energy side of the stream compared to the outside is erosional point. So when the flood subsides, it drops the gold on that river bar on the inside. Now, when the next flood comes along, of course, that gold is picked up and carried on farther down the stream. And the gold that's been deposited higher up in the stream on another bar is brought down and deposited on that bar. Now, here's a little story, and it's kind of fun. When I first started in teaching mining extension at the University of Alaska, I happened upon the Yukon River, and there was a little fellow there. He was about, I guess he was 3 or 4. He was in diapers, as a matter of fact. And he was panning gold on the banks of the Yukon. And I asked him, I says, "You getting any gold?" And he bent over there, and he showed me 2 or 3 little specks of gold in his pan. He was getting gold right off the riverbank of the Yukon River at Circle City. I've got pictures of him. Now, the point being, it's fine gold. But the point being, that's flood gold that's been brought down and deposited on the banks of the Yukon. Now, let's step back to pay street gold. Pay street gold is this gold that's too heavy or has a characteristic like sphericity, which is round, BB-like, and it will work its way down through the gravels and occupy the interface of the gravels and bedrock. Well, the interesting part of this is that occasionally a stream has very shallow bedrock, shallow gravel to bedrock. And with that in mind, it doesn't take much to get down to it. And a person getting down to it can clean out the cracks and crevices at bedrock and come up with surprisingly large amounts of gold. When I say large, I'm not talking multiple ounces. I'm talking a quarter of an ounce or an eighth of an ounce. And that's a lot of gold for one day, by any measure. So, but that's Pay Street gold, under the gravel, at the interface of the gravel and the bedrock. Sometimes the bedrock is extremely deep. In Fairbanks, Alaska, Chattanooga, I was over 100 feet deep to bedrock. Sometimes in the 40 mile, you can see bedrock poking itself out of the middle of the stream. So there you have the two end members. Now, so if I was to say one thing to a person about flood gold and Pay Street gold, do not dig any deeper than 4 inches beneath the surface of a river bar, because, and I think you should go, a potential prospector should go treat himself to this experience. Do not go deeper than 4 inches because there's no gold there. The flood gold that is there, was there, would have been lost either to being moved downstream, or it will have been subjected to one of the 10-year cycles or 20-year cycles of flooding that has agitated the entire bedload of gravel, and that gold will have precipitated down to form a Pay Street deposit. So there's nothing there. It's barren, and you waste a lot of time. Just take the skim gold, the skim gold. That's what flood gold is, it's skim gold, the kind of gold that occurs within the first 2 or 3 inches of the surface.
Can you actually, in a gold pan, capture that flood gold?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's sometimes, the best flood gold you'll find is that which is flat. It hydrofoils itself down the stream. And it can be as big as your small fingernail. Big, but flat. And another thing about gold is if it sees air, it would rather have air surrounding it like a cloak than water, and so it will, the air will float it too. So air, the sphericity or lack of sphericity will be factors which control large amounts of flood gold. Now back before the turn of the century in Yukon, Ogilvy witnessed, Ogilvy was the big Canadian man in the Yukon in those days, he witnessed a bar, now this was before gold was 35, it was $20 an ounce. On one bar, the men took out $75,000 worth of flood gold. So, you know, it's not out of the question. And, probably important to everybody is that the activity surrounding placer gold mining, which is the poor man's mining, that activity is controlled by the gold price. Back in 1983, in the 70s and 83, gold went up in price to $850 an ounce. When it reached $850 an ounce, there was a frenzy of activity. But 1983, gold plummeted. First to $700, $600, even below $400 an ounce, and all the interest in gold mining dropped off. The only people left in gold mining then were the serious guys. Okay, that lasted up until, probably 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, when gold started climbing again. And again, there was a frenzy. More mines were being opened, placer mines, more claims were being staked. Just a myriad of different ways
and ideas came into the gold placer mining industry. And it's surprising to me, I have to, a lot of people don't know my background, and they tell me about how big they are in the placer mining industry. And I smile, and I say, yeah, well, you've got a loader and a cap. And I've been there and seen that to myself. I say, yeah, that's pretty good. You're doing swell. And then there's the other end of it, that these little guys with a little backhoe and a little sluice box, and they're making a little salary off of it. Mom and pops, really mom and pops. And I see these things happening. They're all there now. They're all there at $1,500 an ounce. They're there. Let the gold drop below 1,000 and watch where they are. How many, there's going to be a lot of claims up here, but there's not going to be anybody working them. Where are they? They've given up because they can't afford to mine it. The price of fuel stopped to begin with. But that same thing happened in 1983. They died. My business, it dropped to a level that was, you can't kill my business. It just won't die, because it always takes in just enough money to keep it alive. And keeping it alive is keeping the lights on, water, sewer, and the taxes. And that's all that's required. And the business has done well. Even the lean years, there was enough business. And I'm using the business, my business, as the icon for how much gold mining equipment is purchased. There will always be the recreationals, gold panner, sluice boxes, and people out there to have fun, to find a little gold. Not to make a living, but to go out, take their families out, pan a little gold, and have a wiener roast and some beans out in the bush somewhere, and enjoy their life as Americans. And that's just another way. Guys will continue to carry a gold pan with them when they go hunting. These kinds of things will never die. Doesn't matter what the price of gold is, there will always be those kinds of purchases. And I'm there to serve these people. And it's so much fun. It is so much fun. You just see them, their eyes get really bright, and you want to help them because you know they're going out and have an experience. So I can honestly say that I saw it die in 1983 and down below $300, below $400 an ounce. And then I saw it rise again, and I took advantage of the rise in gold prices, and I was right there to meet the needs of the people with the equipment. And today it's leveled off. We're at $1,500 an ounce, but it's leveled off at a very comfortable level. And I don't see it as going down much farther, as long as gold stays up around $1,500 to $2,000 an ounce. It will continue to draw that kind of interest until the day it drops below $1,800 an ounce. You can just about imagine that we will be down to the level of 1985 to 2000. We will be down there, and which is okay with me, because I understand the cycling effect. Other businesses that come in that don't understand that, and there are other businesses coming in to sell mining equipment, they better prepare themselves, because when it dies, they're going to have a lot of inventory hanging on their shelf. They're not going to sell it. And me, Alaskan Prospector, heck, we sell rocks and minerals. We don't care. We're happy. We're happy in serving everybody. We'll do the best we can, and if there's a possibility that we can contribute any information, advice to certain people that will make their outside activity or gold dredging activity a success, we'll do that. Because if they're successful, the Alaskan Prospector